Welcome to Behind the Sports Medicine Podcast. I'm your host, Andrew Rizza. I'm an allied healthcare professional that has worked in the industry for over 25 years, with the majority of my practice being in the private physical therapy space and in public school athletics. My curiosity prompted me to create Behind the Sports Medicine Podcast to discuss the ever-changing landscape in the healthcare industry, focusing on sports medicine, physical therapy, athletic training, and sports science. Each week, we will discuss the barriers that healthcare professionals face and how we as individuals can collaborate to make the listener better understand the industry for a better patient and athlete experience. Now, on to the show. On this week's Behind the Sports Medicine Podcast, I'd like to welcome Dr. Lee Riley. Lee is a licensed physical therapist with 28 years of experience in the physical therapy and rehabilitation space. He received a Bachelor of Science degree in physical therapy from Northeastern University in 1996, a Master of Education degree in exercise science from Louisiana State University in 2002, and a Doctor of Philosophy degree in physical therapy from Nova Southern University in 2011. Lee is an instructor for the Department of Physical Therapy, Movement and Rehabilitation Sciences, and the College of Professional Studies at Northeastern University in Boston, Massachusetts. His academic teaching, clinical practice, and research interests focus on development and promotion of evidence-informed management and rehabilitation approaches for adults with musculoskeletal spinal disorders. Lee has served as the program lead for the Willis-Knighton Spine Institute in Shreveport, Louisiana from 1998 to 2017. During this time, he provided administrative supervision and clinical leadership for an interdisciplinary team of healthcare professionals from the fields of physical therapy, rehabilitation nursing, social services, and behavioral therapy in operations and promotion of a CARF-accredited outpatient medical rehabilitation program for adults with musculoskeletal spine disorders. Under Lee's guidance and leadership, the Willis-Knighton Spine Institute grew from a novel pilot program and developed into an integrated model of care-promoting biopsychosocial management and rehabilitation principles through the Willis-Knighton Health Department of Physical Medicine and Rehabilitation. Over the last several years, Lee has assumed many roles and was most recently promoted to expand his leadership role as the Assistant Director for Outpatient Services in the Willis-Knighton Health Department of Physical Medicine and Rehabilitation. In his new position, Lee leads a diverse team of healthcare professionals, including physical therapists, occupational therapists, speech and language pathologists, rehabilitation nurses, athletic trainers, social workers, and behavioral therapists in the operation and promotion of the Willis-Knighton Sports Medicine Program and all the CARF-accredited outpatient medical rehabilitation programs offered by Willis-Knighton Health throughout the Shreveport and Boise City communities. Lee has a passion for teaching, promoting, and practicing a patient-centered approach to healthcare delivery that integrates evidence-based standards of care with patient values, preferences, and expectations to develop cost-efficient and clinically effective rehabilitation programs for the person served. Now, on to the show.
Hey, Lee, thanks for joining the podcast today. Hi, everybody. This is Behind the Sports Medicine Podcast. I have Lee Riley, Willis-Knighton Health Systems in Louisiana. Lee is a lifelong friend. I think Lee and I met each other in seventh grade, played some football together through middle school, high school. And, you know, he was the reason why I actually went to college. I didn't know what the hell I was going to do when I was going to get out of high school. Lee and I went to a vocational school. He was in the painting department. I was in the carpentry department. And then I think one day, Lee, you said, "What do you do when you graduate?" I'm like, "I don't know. I guess I'd become a carpenter." He's like, "Well, I think I'm going to go to Northeastern and look in Northeastern in Springfield for physical therapy." And I said, "What's physical therapy?" And then, you know, you and I think took that old Chevy Nova of yours out to Springfield. Correct me if I'm wrong, but that was a pretty interesting trip that we had. And here we are today. Pretty amazing that we're still doing what we went to school for. Minus, obviously, I didn't get into PT school because I wasn't as smart as you. I got into AT school and then I had to go back to get my PTA degree. So, but here we are. Thanks, Lee. Hit it.
Thanks for having me on. I like what you're doing here.
Yeah, I think it'll be great. We'll chat a little bit about kind of your journey, where you are now, some of the challenges I think that you guys might face in your workforce and your workplace, what type of patients you guys are seeing, and then where you think healthcare is kind of going. So thanks again. I appreciate it.
No, my pleasure.
So as I said, Lee and I grew up, friends throughout high school, and then we went to Northeastern together. He was a physical therapy major. I was an athletic training major. And then Lee ventured out, did some traveling PT, right, Lee? You and Katie, and then ended up in Louisiana. So can you give me a little bit background on where you are now and kind of what you're doing?
Yeah, sure. Yeah, I mean, you know, I was at Mass General. Yeah, you know, went to Northeastern, you know, and then graduated from Northeastern, went to work at Mass General, and then, you know, worked there for about a year, and then got the opportunity to go and run a private practice. And so tried that for a year, and then got married, and then decided, you know, okay, you know, I'm going to go in one or two directions here. I'm either going to, you know, buy this private practice, you know, be a private practice owner, you know, or I'm going to go back to school. And I always entertained the idea of going back to school, you know, and getting my PhD. And so my wife and I decided, well, you know, let's travel, because back in the 90s, traveling therapy was really popular. And so we decided, well, let's travel, you know, for a year or two. We just got married, you know, we didn't have any ties. And so I left the private practice and then went. We traveled for about 6 months, and then the whole market collapsed. You know, there was some legislation that was passed in 97 that changed the way, you know, that, you know, rehabilitation facilities were paid for services. And so the market really started contracting. And so we were down here in Louisiana working for the Willis Knighton Health System. And we finished our contract with them, went on a cruise for about 10 days. And then we came back from the cruise, checked into a hotel, and called our contract company and said, well, what do you got for us? Where are we going? And they had nothing.
Yeah.
So we sat in the hotel for a week or so, and the phone didn't ring. And then we started worrying, like, this is a horrible decision we made, you know, that, you know, to do this. So we went back to Willis Knighton and asked them to re-sign our contracts. And they weren't taking any more contract therapists, but they had FTE positions available. So we decided, well, let's just do that. Let's just take a full-time position until we get our feet settled and we figure out what our next move is. And then, you know, we've been here ever since. You know, the health system that we work for has grown and expanded, you know, during our time here. And I was able to create a service line for the health system. My wife created a service line, you know, for the health system. And so we've built careers here, you know, because of the opportunities that were presented. Opportunities that we probably wouldn't have had if we had stayed, you know, in the greater Boston area. Who knows?
Yeah, it's interesting. You and I chatted a little bit before we started this session, and about how there's not a lot of, you know, therapists, athletic trainers, or actually people in the workforce today that stayed in a job for their career. It's very rare these days. And you and I are one of those people, and it sounds like your wife, Katie, is too, where you stay with one employer. And I've always said, you know, the grass is always green until you're standing on the grass. And with orthopedics, what are we doing every day? We're doing the same thing. We might be with a different organization. Our salaries may differ a little bit, but not too much. And I think you have to build that sense of community where you're working and get to know the people around you so you can provide service to that community. And it sounds like that's what you guys are doing.
Yeah, I mean, you have to decide, I mean, you know, is it a job or is it a career? You know, and I mean, if it's a job, if you see the work you do as a job, well, then, you know, you're going to bounce around and, you know, and try to get the best paying job that you can. Or if you're lucky enough to get with a company where you can actually build a career, I mean, that's just a different ballgame. You know, and so, you know, we were very fortunate. You know, if you had asked me, you know, when I was, you know, in my 20s, hey, do you think you'd be living in Louisiana, you know, 20 years from now? I'd say, no, absolutely not. Like, Louisiana, the only thing I knew about Louisiana was New Orleans, you know?
Yeah.
I mean, no, not at all. And so, but, you know, we were fortunate enough to find a company, you know, and find a health system, you know, that was looking for people to come in and help them grow and help them achieve their mission in this community. And we were fortunate. Like I said, we were very fortunate.
Yeah, that's great. That's great. What can you describe a little bit about your role and what you do as a clinical director? And then, you know, how does that translate to the community?
Yeah, I mean, it's changed. I mean, so, you know, in 99, you know, I created a service line for the health system where the goal of the program, it was to specifically address the needs of adults with musculoskeletal spinal disorders. And so we created what is now called the Spine Institute. And so, you know, I grew that program. At one point, you know, I had a orthopedic physician, I had a neurosurgeon, a physiatrist, pain management doc, who was working in the clinic with us. And we would provide, you know, comprehensive, you know, evaluation and management programs, you know, for all the folks that we would take care of. Then I brought in a behavioral therapist, you know, and we offered behavioral therapy, reaching counseling, you know, for these folks that had chronic pain. And the program just grew from there. And then I started scaling it. and, you know, taking the principles that we use in the spine program and, you know, that biopsychosocial, psychologically informed management approach. And we started, you know, kind of integrating that into our other orthopedic programs, into our neurological service line. And so I ran the spine program for 18 years. Then I moved into other leadership positions within the department. And then in 2018, I took over as the assistant director for the department. And then now I manage all of our outpatient service lines. I manage our sports medicine program, you know, and I really provide oversight, you know, and kind of direction, you know, for where the programs are going.
Yeah, that's great. Do you still provide clinical care or are you just mostly administrative now?
I do see patients. I mean, you know, I've been practicing in this community now for over 20 years.
Yeah.
You know? I mean, so I think, you know, I'm going on 26 years now in this community. So you build up reputations, you know, you build, you know, relationships with, you know, with physicians. And then they'll call you and say, hey, listen, I've got someone I want you to take a look at. Do you mind? I'll say, yeah, we'll get on the schedule. You know, and then I manage it that way. You know, so that's kind of how I do. I mean, I don't see patients, you know, just, you know, come in on a routine basis. My staff takes care of that. But if a physician calls me and says, hey, you know, I value your opinion. Can you take a look at somebody for me? I'll say, yeah, absolutely.
Yeah. What's the percentage of patients that you guys get in that are outpatient versus inpatient, or is it strictly outpatient? Does it transition across the hospital where you get both?
So we have, we operate four, our health system operates four acute care hospitals.
Okay.
We have a freestanding rehabilitation hospital. So, and I have five outpatient clinics that are associated with all those facilities. And so we offer everything from, you know, we have a neonatal ICU, you know, so where you're seeing, you know, we have PT, OT and speech services, you know, in the ICU, all the way to assisted living. And we have, you know, assisted living facility where we have, you know, PT, OT and speech services there.
That's good.
So it's across the entire lifespan.
So my daughter graduates and she wants to go to Louisiana. I have her call you to get a speech therapy job.
I need to grow our speech therapy program.
I could tell her to come down. Definitely. Then I'd come down and eat some crawfish.
You could come on now, get some barbecue, some crawfish.
That's the one thing. We went to Louisiana for NATA. This is, I don't know. I think Lily was probably, what's she, 24 now. She had to be 10. So we were down there and we ended up on Bourbon Street and we're walking on Bourbon Street. And I'm like, horse blinders, horse blinders, horse blinders. And then we go down and we actually sat in a bar and she got to hang out. It was during the day. But the best thing about Louisiana, the food was amazing. People were amazing. We had a great time. Love to come back again.
I raised three kids here. I mean, if we were in Northeastern, if you had said, hey, where do you see yourself? Do you see yourself living in the South, you know, living in Louisiana? I'm like, no, absolutely not.
Yeah.
I mean, I never would have thought about it. But the people down here are great and the food is great, you know, and we're, you know, we're pretty far from New Orleans. I mean, we're, you know, we're in the northwest corner. Shreveport is in the northwest corner of the state.
Yeah.
So we're about 350 miles from New Orleans. But yeah, like, you know, when we were younger, we would go to New Orleans more often. Not so much anymore.
Yeah. That's good, though. You guys are in a good place. You're providing a great service, that's for sure, for what you guys are doing. And that's pretty amazing that you're able to do that for the community. And I find that there's always, you know, we talk about this frequently, and it's about, you know, building a sense of community within the organization you're working with to provide for the people that are there, because what you do every day is life-changing for these people. And I think some of the younger therapists or out there, trainers, for that matter, I don't think understand the impact that they have with the people that they're working with or their families. That's why I always go back to, you know, trying to root yourself in the community, trying to be able to expand what you're doing every single day and get to know the people around you, get to know the doctors, go and do rounds, go and sit in the OR and see some surgeries, go to educational sessions, have the doctors see if they'll come in and do sessions for you at your clinics. That's what builds that relationship and builds the community, but also builds your reputation to become a therapist that they want to send people to. And I was very fortunate and, you know, with Mass General and Children's and, you know, the Baptist being right around the corner from us, I got to meet a lot of the orthopedic surgeons because of my team physician for Weston. So a lot of his fellows came through and they sat on the sideline with me at football and they stayed to become orthopedists in the area. Or if they went to a different community, I was able to still use them as, you know, being able to bounce things off of or communicate with them. And that's what made me, you know, grow the practice that I have in both the PT space and athletic training. So it's definitely important.
Yeah. Well, I mean, that's the thing. I mean, if you want to become the provider of choice, you know, in your community, then you got to put in the work. Yeah. I mean, you know, it's just not, it's not a, you know, 9 to 5 or 8 to 4:30 job.
Yeah.
I gotta put in the work.
You've been working 26 years and you're at work on Sunday.
Right.
Like, how many people are going to say, you know what? I'm not going to work today. Fuck, going to work on a Sunday. What am I doing? Like, yeah. I've been working for 26 years. I shouldn't be going to work on a Sunday.
I mean, it's one of those things where it's like when I was younger and I was growing the Spine Institute, I would go every opportunity, you know, I would have to do something in the community. I mean, if it was, you know, the Knights of Columbus or the Lions Club or the local junior league or whatever, any community organization that needed a speaker, I was stepping up, you know, and going and doing community lectures just because I wanted to get my name out there, wanted to grow the program. And I did all that pretty much off the clock.
Yeah.
Those weren't things that I got paid for. I got paid while I was in the clinic. But all the other stuff I did to grow, you know, the program, you know, were all just things that I did because I thought that that was important, you know, and it was meaningful. And I saw value in it. It's hard now, you know, to get these young staff to do anything extra.
Yeah. You know, work-life balance.
That is like, I don't, that term work-life balance, I'm like, that was something that when we were coming up, like that wasn't a thing.
No. And I, you know, I learned way back. I mean, you know, my dad was, I was working with my dad when I was like 12. Right. And I go to work with him and, you know, my dad owned a big commercial cleaning company. And I always tell people, like, I wouldn't ask you to do what I haven't done. I mean, I cleaned toilets with my father. I emptied trash. We went to these big spaces and cleaned. And I learned what it was like to work and work hard. And I mean, we did what we had to do to be able to get by and to be able to provide, right? And I look back to when we were at Northeastern. I remember you were at school all day, clinical, and you worked at Burger King. Like, what'd you have to do? I had to work at Burger King. Like, it baffles my mind that a lot of the young, and even my daughter, for instance, like, she's in school right now in her grad program, and she's like, I don't like my job. Well, like, what, you work in a clothing boutique selling high-end clothing to people that have kids? Like, go to work, earn some money. You have more than enough time to do this. You have to start making some money. I think a lot of this was our doing too. I mean, as parents, we want to give the best to our kids.
Yeah.
But it floats back to, like, you know, how do we make them understand? I still work 14-hour days. I mean, this week I'm working, you know, 6:30 in the morning till 9 o'clock at night every night this week. It's the end of the spring season. So, I mean, I got a busy week, but I'm going to work every day doing what I need to do to provide for the people that need me to be there for them. But I also think the social media thing you and I touched on a little bit at the beginning, I feel like this whole social media kind of drive that people get every single day is deterring them to do what they should be doing because people think you shouldn't do this, you shouldn't do that, you should be going out and doing this, or don't stay in the work environment like we talked about before for your whole career. Why is that? Because, well, we think that you need to be able to keep changing gears because there's something better out there for you, which there may be, but how realistic is that going to be if you can't kind of cement yourself in the community and do what you'd like to do every day?
Yeah, I mean, that's, you know, I think, you know, and I have teenagers and they're inundated, you know, with messages, you know, through social media, you know, about, you know, don't be a sucker, don't stay with one company your whole life, you know, bounce around, you know, and, you know, don't do what your parents did, you know, because, you know, the companies don't care about you, there's no loyalty to the employees, so jump around, get yours, you know your value, you know, and I, you know, people always think the grass is greener, you know, in someone else's yard, and, you know,
right.
I tell my employees, listen, the grass is greener where you water it.
I mean, that's right, that's a good one.
You need to learn how to water your yard. You know, you need to learn how to, you know, to make your environment your own. And inevitably, there are environments that you'll get to work in. You're like, yeah, this is not for me. You know?
Yeah, 100%.
But, you know, but the idea that, you know, you're constantly, you know, looking for your next job, you miss the opportunities that you have in your current job. And so, and those are things, you know, I try to instill that in my kids. You know, and the challenge, you know, and you probably experienced this as well. You can hustle and hustle and hustle, and you can be the most productive person, you know, in your environment, and people won't necessarily emulate what you're doing.
Correct.
You know,
correct.
They won't, you know, you can lead by example only to a certain point, you know, and then that's not going to bring people and be able to raise their performance. So the challenge, you know, when you're in a leadership position, as I am now, is how do I get, you know, it's not me who should be doing all the work. Me working harder is not the answer. The right. idea is, how can I get my team to work harder? How can I motivate my team? And just leading by example sometimes isn't enough.
Yeah, and that's the challenge. I was talking to my boss the other day about this. And, you know, we look at team-based care as being, you know, the best way that we can provide for our patients that come in outpatient PT. It's how do we, you know, classify the, you know, complexities from high to low, and how can you manage that through the clinic? And, you know, if you look, the CDs in the clinics are usually the busiest, and they shouldn't be. You know, I have staff saying, why do you have 14 patients in your schedule today? I'm like, well, because you're not busy. You know, it's like, why don't you have 14 on your schedule? You know, and I think they feel like, one, are they providing the best care? And, you know, if you look at a lot of the research and literature out there, it doesn't mean because you're the busiest, doesn't mean you're providing great care. You provide great care how you know how to provide the care. So if you know how to provide what is needed the time that patient comes in and provide it in the way that the patient needs it, you could still be look very busy, but you're not providing it the way that you should be providing it and feel like you're overwhelmed when you're not. And that's the challenge. That being said, like, how do you guys, how do you value team-based care in your clinics, and how does that work? Do you have a team approach, or are you just, you know, one-to-one depending on what you're dealing with in the clinic? How does that look?
Yeah, I mean, like, so in our outpatient centers, we have an interdisciplinary team. So we have PT, OT, speech. We have rehabilitation nursing. You know, we have case management. We have rehabilitation counseling services. So, you know, not everyone, you know, who we see requires the services of all of those individuals. Certainly more complex cases are going to be managed under an interdisciplinary team approach. Mm-hmm. In our neurological service line, you know, we're taking care of adults after they've had strokes or spinal cord injuries or something of that nature, it's much more of a team approach, you know, than they may be receiving all three disciplines, maybe taking care of them. On our orthopedic service line, we take care of our sports medicine program manages 15 area high schools. And I have, I have 13 athletic trainers, you know, who work in our programs. And so they work with the sports medicine specialists, you know, in our outpatient centers, you know, to meet the needs of the student athletes that we're caring for. And so, you know, it varies, you know, it varies based on the needs of the individual. You know, but it's nice, you know, working for a large health system, you know, we have all those resources. You know, we have the ability to do that. I mean, it would be tough, you know, if I was in an independent practice and it was just, you know, physical therapy, you have to put more work in to find that network. Like, you have to go out and actually create that network. So, you know, if you needed, you know, speech therapy services or occupational therapy, or if you needed counseling for your patients, you know, how would you get that? You know, if you were, you know, in the community on your own, that'd be a lot more challenging.
Yeah. You know, we, with ATI, the one thing that we have, which is nice, is that we're not just outpatient orthopedics. We also have industrial setting or health services. So we have sports med. We have, it's called ATI Worksite Solutions or AWS. And that's in more, you know, like your Gillette, your GE Aviation, like those big size companies that we have either an athletic trainer in there working or a PT working in there to work with industrial athletes, we call them now, because what are they doing every day? They're moving, and they're the people that help within, you know, factories, organizations that need to stay at work. We have a pretty big workman's comp program, a work conditioning program. And then, so we're really trying to link all of those together to try to provide the best care. You know, if we find that a lot of our industrial injuries, their families also need direct access. So how do we get them direct access to PTs? How do you, your sports medicine, if you, you know, you talked a little bit about athletic training and sports medicine, you have 13, you know, athletic trainers that work under you or work in the sports medicine section. How do they provide direct access? Meaning, like, if they see an athlete at the school, what's that look like to get them into PT if they're not able to provide the PT services in the athletic training setting? How does that look direct access related, as far as like, if I was the athletic trainer and said, hey, Lee, you know what? I got this kid, fresh ACL. Can I get him in right away? Like, what does that look like? How do you guys manage that?
Yeah. So the nice thing is that the athletic trainers are the liaison, you know, uh-huh. you know, between, you know, the school, you know, and then the orthopedic specialists, you know, in the clinics, you know, and we have board certified orthopedic specialists, and we have board certified sports medicine specialists mm-hmm. in the clinics who work with the athletic trainers and sports medicine program. You know, those athletic trainers have the docs, you know, phones. If they need somebody, they need something, they call the doc, you know, and, you know, they'll go ahead and get that order. I mean, the nice thing with the athletic trainers is that because they are like the tip of the spear out in the community, you know, if something needs to get done, they can help expedite that process. You know, one of the real problems that we've had, you know, in recent years you know, is getting, you know, quick access to imaging. You know, we have a large health system. We have more imaging modalities than anybody else in this region. But, you know, the problem is that, you know, as the director, if you're the director of radiology, your job is to make sure that all of those imaging modalities are booked out for weeks ahead of time. You know, so that's your job. So then, you know, if you get a kid and you need, you know, imaging right away, then it's like, okay, well then, you know, how are we going to get that? How are we going to get that to work? So yeah, that's been a problem in recent years that we've really, really worked hard on is getting expedited access to imaging, you know, for the sports medicine program. You know, like I said, I mean, you know, we have more MRIs, more CTs, you know, more imaging modalities than anyone in the area, but they're booked out, you know, for a reason. I mean, they're booked out, you know, by design. So getting folks in, it's really the athletic trainers, you know, are there contacting the docs and letting them know, or getting them into emergency medical services.
Yeah, which is good. And we talk about this as well up here, is that, you know, the first line of defense is your athletic training staff. And if they can provide the right assessment day one, and they understand what the, you know, the brevity of getting that patient in and to get them back to doing what they do, is very important. And to miss, you know, time, you know, off the field is precious for them. But also, how do we make that, you know, an easy transition? You know, I was talking to Dr. Gill, who I think you know from, was at Mass General, as a chief of orthopedics there. Now he's over at Steward and part of the Baptist. You know, him and I were talking about, you know, ACL reconstructions and you know, now how are they managing, you know, surgical procedures with ACLs, and how quickly are they getting them in? And it all comes down to, you know, identifying it, getting the range of motion back right away, getting their quad to work, and being able to get them into surgery faster than to wait that 6 to 8 weeks, which is can be, you know, for a young athlete or even for a collegiate athlete or even somebody that's working in the workforce, can be a little bit longer for them. But I think that's important to have a staff that can, you know, to get them in quickly, and doctors and therapists that also want to be able to provide that service as well.
Yeah, I mean, it's really important. I mean, like I said, our athletic trainers, you know, do a fantastic job on the community. And like I said, they are the infrastructure that we have built in our sports medicine program. You know, we use it to market to young, you know, surgeons, you know, young, you know, orthopedic surgeons who want to be team physicians, you know, because we have the infrastructure already set up for them. You know, if they're looking to join the health system, you know, we can let them know. So listen, so we've got, you know, 15 high schools. You want to be on the sidelines. You want to be to get your name out there in the community. You know, we can help you because we've got a program that's already set up for that. You know, that you can come in, you know, and start getting a name for yourself in the community. So that's really been beneficial. I mean, we watched the sports medicine program during COVID, honestly.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, that was a big thing for us, too.
Yeah.
You know,
I worked hard to keep the athletic trainers employed all through COVID. We actually, you know, the hospital, we needed to have screening stations at each of our hospitals. Like all of the entrances had to have screening stations. So I took all the athletic trainers because sports were shut down, you know, here in Louisiana. And so during COVID, you know, for a good bit of time. And so I took all the athletic trainers and we put them at screening stations, and, you know, we were able to keep them working. Whereas, you know, a lot of programs just laid off their athletic trainers or shut down the programs.
Yeah, we had a really tough time. I don't know how you guys dealt with it, you know, inpatient as well. We had, I mean, it was like somebody punched you in the face, you know, 25 times. I think it was, you know, when COVID hit, we didn't know what the hell was going on, especially outpatient PT. And I had 15 staff working with me in Wellesley, and I went down to just me and another PT. So we furloughed everybody. Half the company got furloughed. Some of those people didn't, you know, they furloughed them, which was great for, you know, from, I don't know, May, all the way to September, which was great. But then when they called people back, it was where the need was in the clinic, and they had a radius of where you could go. And some people, like, I'm not traveling an extra 15 minutes to go to work. I'm like, what are you talking about? Like, I'm driving 40 minutes to get to work. Like, and they found other jobs. And I feel like that was one of the things that it just baffles me that you're working for an organization you like working for. They asked you to come back. They held your job. You end up, you know, in the state of Massachusetts, it was crazy. Like, you could collect and still get your furlough benefits. So they were making more money not working and their full benefits. And then when you asked them to come back, they're like, nah, really, I don't think I want to. So for me, that was like, it blew my mind. And I don't know how you guys dealt with it down there, but I was like, I was so pissed off because we just like held the fort and provided what we needed to provide every single day. We were on the front lines, basically working with patients every single day. Mm-hmm. I didn't have a day off. And it was nuts. And, you know, some of those people did still stay with the organization, but some moved on for whatever reason. You know, that was their, you know, their reason is their reason. But that was the hard part. And I still think it took us almost, I mean, almost 3 years to get, I mean, right now it's so 3 years since COVID, almost four. So 2.5 years after it started, we almost got back to where we were, you know, productivity, but also patient facing the amount of staff, which is crazy.
Yeah. I mean, we, you know, when everything shut down, you know, we shut down services except for those services that were, if we determined it was going to cause the patient harm, you know, to not receive services, mm-hmm. you know, then we still brought those in. You know, we saw them in one-to-one blocks, you know, for 60 yep. minutes, one-to-one, you know, and then as, you know, as the state started to open up and allow us to be able to bring more patients in, then we transitioned, you know, from one-to-one in 60-minute blocks to one-to-one 45-minute blocks. And then, you know, really, I mean, now since then, because prior to COVID, you know, we were seeing patients in 30-minute blocks. So, and you'd have patients overlapping. You as a therapist would have multiple, you'd have two or three patients in the office at one time. Now, yeah. since COVID, you know, because we took the opportunity to really look at some of our business practices and see what do patients really, you know, value, and then look at how, you know, we're billing for services. Now we've been able to return to one-to-one 45-minute block appointments mm-hmm. And provide that one-to-one service with the patient and still meet all of our financial obligations. We've not gone back to the pre-COVID skin structure, you know, where you're overlapping patients and, you know, you have multiple patients in the clinic at once. And it's worked out great.
That's good. And I feel like it varies state to state with reimbursement, especially, I mean, hospital, you guys get probably a little bit higher rate. I know in Mass, we really struggle with the reimbursement model. It's up and down. That's the hard part with clinics. And it leads me to the next question, you know, where mom and pops end up going as far as outpatient practice. You know, do you think that those, you know, practices are going to survive if we look at healthcare moving the way it is in the future with reimbursement rates and, you know, managed care? We talked about this over and over and over again through the years. And, you know, Carl Gustafson, who was the owner of Sports and PT, who hired me out of college, him and I are still pretty good friends. We talk all the time. I consider a really, you know, big mentor for me, my career, and how I kind of developed as an athletic trainer, as a young therapist. And I think, you know, one of the things he talked about when he got out of Northeastern's PT program almost 35 years or even close to 40 years ago, said, you know, it was $10 a copay, $5 to $10 a copay, and you were getting reimbursed $100 a visit, every single visit, or pretty close to that. He goes, flash forward, you know, 30 plus years, the patient is now paying $50, $60, $75 a copay, and you're getting reimbursed $125. So a lot of practices around us, I don't think they're going out of business. There's still practices that are growing and trying to get bigger. But where do you think that, you know, mom and pop one and two or three office businesses are going with the way healthcare is, or where you think healthcare is going?
I mean, I think, you know, a lot of the smaller PT practices are trying to move towards a cash-based model, you know, and trying to get out of, you know, the insurance business, you know. And so I see that a lot more. You know, we have private practices. Ironically, most of the private practices in our community are owned by former employees of ours. So they came in, you know, to the health system. We trained them up, you know, we built their collaborations and their network, and they got their name in the community through working for us.
And then they stole all your patients.
And then, like, they own their own place, you know, which is, like I said, man, I wish them the best. I mean, it's quite a risk, and it's a daunting, you know, project to take on, you know, your own business. Like I said, I ran a private practice for a year, you know, and, you know, I was working 70 hours a week, you know, mm-hmm. and, you know, running this practice, and you're never not working. I mean, you're never not running the practice, and, you know, and so, you know, the idea is, you know, if you're going to be successful, you have to find, you know, you have to be able to find a way to make a connection and get, you know, those patients to come back to you. Now, the one thing, you know, that I see in the small private practices that are in this community is they have a very strong social media presence. They've been very innovative, you know, in getting out on social media, whether it be TikTok, Instagram, Facebook, or what have you. And then, you know, and really advertising their, you know, their clinics and their services that way. And they advertise, you know, their staff, you know, they promote their staff, you know, through social media. So that's really smart, you know, for them to do that. So, but yeah, it's a challenge. You know, I wouldn't want to be a private practice owner in this environment.
Yeah, I mean, I have a therapist working with me now. He's he owned 5 clinics in Connecticut, him and his brother. He said, yeah, reimbursement, you know, 15, 20 years ago, we were killing it. And he's like, now he's like, I get to the point where I'm like, is this even worth it? So he sold all his practices. He came back up to Massachusetts. He's like on the back nine of his career. So he came to work for me, and he's a great guy. He's very experienced. He's like, I just don't want to deal with that anymore. And, you know, I have these young therapists that are like a year out, 2 years out. They want to go start their own business, and they don't even, doctors don't even know who the hell they are, first of all. And then it's like, how do you get referrals? You know, Carl always said to me, he's like, you know, you go and bang on 10 doors, you probably get 2 doctors that know who you are, and you go bang on 10 more, and you might get another 1 or 2. So he's like, you know, you have to get out in the community, like you said, and you got to do the stuff outside of your regular hours to be successful. You know, therapists say, well, what about cash base? I'm like, okay, you're going to do cash base. How many people are going to actually pay the cash? First of all, if they have a $75 copay, maybe they'll come to you once a week, right? But okay, you have to get the real estate space. You have to get insurance. You have to have a facility license. You have to get your provider numbers if you do want to bill for insurance. If you don't, you just go cash base. Then you have all of your overhead. You have to pay your insurance for you and your employees. You know, so you have to keep people coming to the door. And if the doctors don't know you and you're not providing that service that they like, and you're not making sure that their patients are getting better, then you don't have a foot to stand on. So, or leg to stand on. So it is very interesting. They think that, I think it goes back to the social media. They see it, or they hear other, you know, maybe, you know, students that they went to, or, you know, peers that they went to school with that have started their own companies and it's worked out. I'm sure for everyone that succeeded, there's 10 that fail. And people have always asked me.
These businesses are really, that's a niche market. I mean, you know, the idea is, the challenge too, you know, it's, you know, with being an employer, whether it be in private practice or a small mom and pop, or even for a health system, is, you know, students are coming out now and, you know, they want more, they want to get paid more. They're coming out now. And, you know, since 2015, when all of the degree programs transitioned to a doctorate program, you know, they're all graduating with doctorates in physical therapy. And then the professional organization now is pushing the medical model, where they go through a year of, you know, a year or two of residency, and then, you know, get board certified. And so the idea is, this is the model they're pushing. So then these students get out, you know, and they want to come out, they want to make a 6-figure salary, because they were told that by doing this, getting a doctorate, getting a residency, and then being board certified, you're like, you'll guarantees a 6-figure salary. And the challenge is that, no, you don't, your reimbursement is
too low. Reimbursement drives the bus, and that's the problem.
It's not your credentials. It doesn't matter how many letters are after your name.
Right.
I mean, the care that you're providing, we're going to get reimbursed a certain amount for the care that you're providing. Now, if you can take all those credentials and you can do that, and then you can leverage that by getting more referrals in the community and getting out there in the community and putting in the work and building those networks and, you know, collaborating with the docs and getting them to know who you are, then, like I said, then you may be onto something. But if you're not willing to put that kind of work in, you know, then just going and having more letters after your name is not going to guarantee you more money.
Thank you for tuning into Episode 8, Part 1 of Behind the Sports Medicine Podcast. I'm your creator and host, Andrew Rizza. Tune in on August 29th when Lee and I close out our conversation. Our conversation revolves around the topics of career development, mentorship, reimbursement in healthcare, and the importance of providing quality care. We discuss the need of young professionals to provide their worth and gain experience in order to advance in their careers. We touch on the challenges of reimbursement in the healthcare industry and the potential for value-based payment structures. The conversation moves on to the importance of mentorship and the role it plays in shaping young professionals, and we then close out our conversation with a reflection on an evolving nature of careers and the importance of making a positive impact on others. If you're enjoying the content from today's episode, give us a like, leave a comment, and share on social media. You can find all of our episodes on Apple, Spotify, and wherever you listen to your podcasts. You can also follow us on Instagram at Behind Sports Med Podcast, on X at AJR Sports Sci, or check out our websites at ajrsportscience.podbean.com and at ajrsportscience.com. You can also subscribe to our YouTube channel at AJR Sports Science. Stay tuned for our next episode.